org, LEARNLEVEL.org.
Great. Thanks, Alex. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on Prison Pipeline.
Oh, thank you so much. I hope I really love the work that you're doing and that your listeners that care about a really important, if not sometimes hidden, issue in our society.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland.
Portland.
Listen,
laugh,
learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And we want to talk to you about a very important topic. It is dealing with the issue of AI. And our guest, Karen Howe, has written a book that is widely acclaimed. It is called Empire of AI. And Karen Howe, for those who don't know, is an award-winning journalist, former editor at MIT's Technology Review, known for her deep reporting on the intersection of artificial intelligence, ethics, and society. And, you know, I can go on and on. Her writings appeared in The Atlantic, among other things, and we're now here to talk about her book. There's a lot to cover just in terms of what we're seeing now with AI, and you seem to have been on the cutting edge when the book came out in the direction that it was headed. But now here we are with entire communities upset about data centers being put in their communities. Memphis and Arizona, two places that immediately come to mind. We've done a number of shows on, you know, widespread surveillance with Palantir and other technologies. And now folks are kind of up in arms. And I think more than a few are probably, one, anxious to hear what your thoughts are on some of this, and two, probably want to go pick up the book and read some of the things that you were talking about, because it seemed like we were headed in this direction when you dropped Empires of AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been kind of crazy to think that I finished writing the book before I fully knew that Trump would get reelected and that Silicon Valley would totally be supercharged by the US government to continue aggressively expanding in the way that I read about in the book. And so I feel like a lot of the themes that I tease out in the book have just become even more viscerally urgent. And it is great to see the degree of activation that's been happening among the public and in realizing that the AI industry in its current form is not serving the public interest, and there desperately needs to be more collective action to push back and reshape the industry towards something that is of the public good.
In the book, you start off by talking about, you know, one of the popular platforms. We know it mainly as ChatGPT, but OpenAI. And if I'm reading this correctly, you started off by saying it had a lot of benevolent intentions, that it was really going to be a beneficial tool for the community. I think many of us who use a platform like this have found it to be beneficial. And then it seemed to take a dark turn. Can we walk a little bit through that? And is my read on this correct?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I first came across OpenAI, I started covering the company in 2018, 2019, and it was founded in late 2015. So I started covering it quite still in its early years, all the way up until present day. And I thought back then that the company was very different. It was very altruistic, and that it had really good intentions to build technology in the public interest. In hindsight, after reporting on this company for a while, I am actually more skeptical now that it was ever altruistic, because the origin story of the organization was that Elon Musk and Sam Altman came together to co-found a nonprofit that could counter Google, because Musk was particularly concerned about the fact that Google was dominating AI development as a for-profit company, and he felt that allowing profit incentives to drive this technology could have very negative consequences. But when you think about, even though that sounds, you know, it sounds like a well-intentioned premise, when you think about the root of what Musk and Altman were trying to do, it was ultimately an egotistical project. They were like, Google is doing this thing and dominating this technology that ultimately we want to dominate. We want to make in our image. And so did it transition from an altruistic organization to a more capitalistic and aggressive and reckless one? Or did it kind of just preserve its original ethos as a very egotistical project that has just continued to shift based on that, the personality drive, ideological drive, profit motive? I feel more like it's really the latter. And to your point, that, you know, like, a lot of people have used ChatGPT and they feel like it is something that is beneficial to them or that is helpful to them. What I argue in the book is that to understand to fully evaluate what this technology is and what it's doing for society, you have to consider all of the inputs that go into the production of this technology, not just your individual experience using the tool. And when you consider the inputs, it's all of the data that's been scraped from the internet, all of the intellectual property that's been taken from artists, writers, and creators without their consent or compensation, all of the land, energy, fresh water that is being used to host, power, and cool massive supercomputers and data centers for training these systems, and all of the environmental and public health impacts that are rippling from that. And then ultimately, the technology that's created is also one that does not have even benefits. Sometimes it's helpful for certain work tasks. Other times it will err wildly and lead to, you know, devastating consequences where people are using it for like healthcare and not getting the right information from it, or using it for some kind of work project and having that be extremely low quality and riddled with errors. And then we're starting to see, you know, huge mental health impacts that these technologies are now having on teens and teenagers that are killing themselves after extended use with these tools. And so I try to, in the book, expand the aperture of how people think about what ChatGPT is or what AI is and where it comes from, and ultimately, what does it represent, and do we want to participate in that broader system that it's creating?
Karen Howard's our guest, and you said a lot there, and it spawned off like 50 questions in comments. I want to start with the overall analysis that you gave about us having to consider all that goes into using AI. And as you were talking, my immediate reaction, and I think I'm saying that mine, but I think a lot of people are like, come on, you're party pooping on my, you know, my situation. I'm able to do my homework quicker. I'm able to do my resume quicker. You know, it's like we have been acclimated over the past years, and I don't think it's by accident. I know from working at Clear Channel and Time Warner and being in programming in those companies that it was by design to almost treat our product as a drug. Let's give you a free taste. Let's, you know, be in every aspect of your life. You want a concert, we're there. You want movies, we're there. And mm-hmm. so the game plan at both companies was to be a constant presence in your life. And as my boss at Clear Channel once said, let's make us, you know, meaning a radio station, a bad habit that you can't quit. Said we want to make sure that even if you don't listen to the station, you know what the station's call letters are and who we are. And with Time Warner, you know, with the late Dick Parsons, his thing was, you know, let's reinforce learned behavior. And so back then, folks were doing all this psychological study on, you know, how you would get people locked in to a product even if they didn't realize it was happening. And I can only imagine it's so much more advanced. But I say all that to conclude that we had gotten very used to convenience, and that convenience comes at all costs. I don't care what Karen is going through. I don't care what, you know, the neighbor down the street. I was able to get what I needed accomplished quickly. It satisfied the goals of my job, satisfied what I need to have happen. It made life easier. Why are you coming along and spoiling the party is how I think the reaction is. And so how do we break loose of, you know, a habit that is extended almost 30 years now, of one where we collectively want to be convenience versus being a little bit more outward thinking and taking into consideration the things you raised up?
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like in my own life, I've reached an inflection point with my relationship with technology where I actually constantly feel extremely frustrated by my relationship. I spend way too much time doom scrolling on social media. I spend way too much time looking at screens, holding my smartphone instead of, you know, engaging in conversation with my friends and my family. And I know that. And yet it exactly as you said, it feels like an addiction that I need to really fight with to kick. And so to me, there is a point at which convenience makes your life easier. And at least for me, and I feel like I've spoken with a lot of people over the last couple of years, there is also a point where that convenience gets so strong that you actually don't feel good about it at the end, because you feel like you're hooked onto things that are ultimately not serving you and not allowing you to live your fullest life and have your fullest relationships. And so that from like just from an individual, like person to person, if I were to try to tell someone else, like, why should you be rethinking your relationship with AI and with ChatGPT, that's the first thing that I would point to is like, do you really feel like this extra convenience is serving you, or is it giving you that little dopamine hit in the current moment, but leaving you long-term feeling more hollowed out with life experience, because it's actually depriving you of more precious life experiences. It's depriving you of more precious critical thinking, depriving you of growth so that you can continue having agency and shaping the future that you want to live. And I would wager that actually most people recognize this feeling in their lives, this frustration that they are losing agency and control and the ability to push themselves and shape their future because of Silicon Valley's products and services. And AI is just the latest instantiation of that, and the most extreme instantiation of that, where it is even more addictive than social media. It's even more addictive than Netflix, than your YouTube algorithm, than Amazon's product recommendation system, because it is literally designed to hook you and just you to these chatbots and to continue using them and develop parasocial relationships with them instead of with your family and with like real friends. And so, I totally hear the convenience thing, but I would say like take a step back and really evaluate. Do you actually feel like in the long term this convenience is supporting you living your best life? I actually don't think most people would say yes.
Here's the challenge we have with that. You know, remember there was this term called digital immigrant and digital native. Remember that term? They used to have that back in the days, right?
Yeah.
And for people unfamiliar, it kind of was like the digital native was somebody who, I'll use this as an example, I could read a speech or a book on my phone, right? But my mom was like, I need a hard copy and I need the paper, right? And so she would have been the digital immigrant and I would have been the digital native in terms of how I was able to interact. And what you're talking about, where you're able to take a step back and kind of reflect the way that you just did. I wonder if my kids can do the same thing because they don't have a referencing point. All they know is, you know, technology has been here from the day that they were born to now. They don't have a world where it didn't exist. And so this is the world. And maybe they don't know what a home cooked meal is. They don't know what it is not to have microwavable type of thing, unless you have folks that intervene and say, we're going to go here, we're going to do these things so that you're exposed. But I would say the average person, especially now when they're under so much duress and people working 2 and 3 jobs and trying to get from point A to point B, I don't have time to do all that. I just want to get on my phone and get these dopamine hits and keep it moving. And their offspring, that's all they know. So is it possible that they're feeling that emptiness that you talked about, and they can recognize that it's a result of this addiction to technology?
I actually think the younger generation is far faster at recognizing this than older generations. You don't need to really have existed without technology to experience a digital detox for a day or 2 days or whatever, and then recognize that you feel better. And I think among a lot of younger people that I talk to, like they are much more attuned to the fact that there is an addiction happening that is shaping their brains in ways that they don't like. And they talk about this all the time. Whereas, you know, like when I think about like my parents' relationship with technology, like they're just addicted and they've never thought twice about the fact that they're addicted. And whereas, you know, and like my generation, I was like the in-between generation where I had a childhood that was mostly tech-free, but then I transitioned into having a lot more technology around me. And like me and my friends, when we started having those technologies, we were talking way more often about it and whether or not this was good and healthy and whether we should be integrating more or less than our parents did. So I do actually think that we are seeing more and more awareness, more and more conversation the younger the generations are, because they have the biggest stake in the way that technology is going to continue developing and continue being applied, because their lives are long and they're going to have to deal with this for a really, really long time. So I think that kids, teens, they recognize it way faster than anyone else. And I actually recently, just the other day, saw a chart showing that social media use has been declining for the first time in a couple in about a decade. And they broke it down by generation. This is an article in the Financial Times by John Murdoch Burns. John Burns Murdoch. Please check me on which version of the name it is.
Right.
But he broke it down by generation, and it was actually young people that had had the fastest decline in social media use compared to any other generation.
Hmm. Well, I can't tell, you know, from the students that I got to teach, you know, but if that's true, that's great. And the other challenge that we have is twofold. One, let's go back to the addiction part, right? And the next level of getting somebody hooked from, you know, when you're talking about dopa fiends and short-term gratification, is religion. And you talk about, you know, in the book, this whole notion of quasi-religion. Can we dig into that, and is that somehow related? If you see the products as something that is all-powering, or you kind of couch it in terms of religion, you know, Sam Altman, who I want you to kind of break down for our audience, Steve Jobs, you know, Elon Musk, for some people, are these figures that are bigger than life for folks. And they see them, a lot of people see them, not as I might see you, but as something that needs to be put on a pedestal for better or for worse. And their ideology gets adopted in a way that you have fanatical folks. You know, I mean, I don't like the guy, but I've run into people that think Elon Musk can do no wrong. And you can see what he's able to acquire and what he's doing in places like Texas, where has a whole city, you know, with people going thumbs up. That dude can't do no wrong. Does a lot of wrong to me. But then again, there was a time that Steve Jobs could do no wrong, even though people thought he was a real a-hole. And we can go on and on, but Sam Altman is the latest incarnation of this iconic figure. And you talk about him, and you also talk about quasi-religion. So can you break some of this down for us?
Yeah. So the thing that surprised me the most when I was reporting the book is the degree to which these really intense belief systems have developed within the tech industry that then percolate from the tech industry to the broader public discourse and lead to religious-like rhetoric being spoken within among AI developers and among the public. But the belief systems that have cultivated kind of go, I call it the AGI religion, artificial general intelligence. And this is the term that OpenAI uses and other AI companies use to describe a theoretical moment in which AI software can match human-level intelligence in all respects. And this is a theoretical moment because there isn't really any scientific evidence that this could ever happen, nor is there evidence that we are actually on the path there. And in fact, earlier this year, there was a survey of AI researchers who are not necessarily affiliated with the industry, that, and 75% of them think that we are not actually on the path there with current technologies, current techniques. And so really this idea of AGI and whether or not you think that it is coming and how quickly you think it's coming is all based on belief. It's not based on any kind of observation or science or measurement, whatever. And people call themselves AGI believers. They use this term believer because they know that there isn't really any scientific basis for their convictions about this this theoretical point.
So the folks working inside these companies call themselves that?
Yes, 100%. Yeah, they call themselves believers. And there's two different factions of the AGI religion as I see it. One is the boomers who think that AGI is going to bring us to heaven. The others are the doomers who think AGI is going to bring us to hell. And it's, to me, like they see themselves as polar opposites of one another, but I see them as just reading from the same Bible, but they're just interpreting it differently. You know, one is focused on the utopia, the other is focused on the fire and brimstone. But it is sort of the same, there is this projection of all of their desires of humanity and all of their fears of what where humanity could go onto this one piece of technology that may or may not arrive.
Right.
And Sam Altman is a leader who identified very early on that the best way to essentially control people is to create a mythology, create a religion around that thing. So I quote in the beginning of my book, in the Epigraph, a blog post he wrote in 2013, 2 years before he co-founded OpenAI. And he himself was quoting another person, and the quote went something like, successful people create companies, more successful people create countries, the most successful people create religions. It seems to me that the most successful founders do not set out to create a company, they set out to create a religion. And it turns out that creating a company is the easiest way to do so. And he, you know, he has many reflections online in interviews and in other blog posts that talk about this core idea of understanding human psychology and understanding that we as humans are vulnerable to, we want a bigger mythology to be part of. We want a belief system. We want a mission that is a higher calling. And he really taps into that and kind of cultivates that mythology so that both he can attract capital and talent for developing it, and also he can ward off regulation. He can get the public's buy-in to continue justifying all of the expenditures that his company is making. And so there is this larger narrative in the public discourse that is really driven by the kind of quasi-religious movements within the Valley that you also see all the time in headlines, like AI is going to save us all or kill us all. And all of it stems from this mythology that at the end of the day is really just clouding our judgment around what this technology actually is, what are the impacts that it actually has in the real world, and how does it actually work, and how should we be improving it? Like if you conceptualize a technology as all powerful and basically like a digital god or a digital demon, you can't really critique it and ask questions and scrutinize, because it is more powerful and smarter than you. And so a huge part of my mission as a journalist and a huge part of my mission with this book was to kind of do the opposite, to peel back that mysticism, to really show how this technology actually works, all of its inner workings, and the inner workings of these companies as well, so that you realize that these aren't gods and demons. These are just people making decisions that are just projecting their values into a technology that affects millions of people.
Which, Karen Howe, may make some people upset because you're messing with their religion. You know?
100%. Yeah, 100%.
As you were talking, everything that I read and everything, you know, by the way, those chapters on the boomers and doomers and all that are fascinating and is definitely for prime time reading and reflection. But one, it reaffirms the programming that I saw, you know, with the Clear Channels and Time Warners, you know, because it was about hooking you. But with the ascension of Sam Altman and how he's kind of wrapped himself around this notion of success means that you create religion, you know, going from companies to countries to religion, I'm thinking about the relationship people have with Apple products. And, you know, I mean, we joke around and it's like, you know, I got my Apple phone and you guys with the blue, with the green dots on the other ones, you ruined the text thread and all that. And we joke around about that. And more people have said, you guys are from the cult of Apple, right? I've started hearing that over and over again. And it's interesting because there are other devices that have better cameras. There are the devices that are a little bit more efficient, but I ain't giving up this iPhone, which I know for fact there was a lot of habit-forming techniques that were deployed to kind of get people hooked. I'll just give one quick example. You know, just remembering that when they would have the new iteration of a phone, that part of the job at some of these radio stations I was at was like, we're going to send our team out to the store and we're going to make it seem like it's bigger than life. But that was actually part of an ad campaign, you know, for the most part, because we sat in a meeting. It's like, hey, they bought an ad and we're going to send a street team over to Sun Valley Mall and y'all are going to stand there and make it seem like, you know, there's a long line. Remember, there used to be lines of people outside the mall waiting to get the new, you know, one thing, it's a fun thing, it's an event. That's how it was described. This is a big event. But it was couched as a news story. You know, in later years, it's like, was it really a news story? Or was it part of an ad campaign? Or was it just something that you had to cover because everybody was there? I know for us, it was part of like, this is what we're going to do in exchange for X, Y, and Z. So the point that I'm getting at is that to me, it kind of formed, you know, like I need more of this. It's a cult. And so now if Sam Altman is coming afterwards, I just want to know how much did he look at Apple and see that type of fervor around their product, even if there are other products that are arguably better, but people are locked in and said, you know, let's make this a religion. I've done it. That's what we're going to do. And all of a sudden, you really have, as you said, people call themselves believers. But talk to an Apple person and say, get rid of your iPhone. They'll tell you they're a believer. They might use a different word, but it's the same attitude.
Yeah. So Sam Altman is a huge Steve Jobs fanboy. So he absolutely looked at Jobs and at Apple for a lot of inspiration. I mean, that's part of the reason why he struck up a deal with Johnny Ive, the you know, original designer of at Apple, to create a device with him for OpenAI. I think that's kind of part of him just trying to fashion himself as this generation Steve Jobs. That said, I also think that there is something different about AI, the AI world, that is taken the religion to a new level than Apple. Because Apple was never selling a product that it fashioned as a god itself. You know, like, yes, it would try to use all these tactics to hook you in and get you addicted and make you a brand loyalist. But there is a difference with ultimately, they still, it was clear. Apple never hid the fact that it was a business. It's providing products and services, and it's giving you something that ultimately is actually, it's highly interchangeable. So if ultimately, like, you do not get good value out of the product or the service, you're going to change over to something else. I hear you with the, you know, like, I'm also an Apple user, and like I haven't upgraded to another camera or anything like that. But if the Apple camera were like crappy, like if the phone just like stopped working, then of course you would go to something else. And there is still this inherent, there's still like a trade that Apple is making with you, where it's like, okay, I'm going to take good care of you as a user. And that's part of the reason why you keep coming back and keep being part of this cult of Apple. But there's something different about AI. First of all, they fashion their products and services as far more than just a product or a service. They're calling, you know, Meta calls their products your friends. And OpenAI is calling it something that is going to be more intelligent than you. I mean, Sam Altman talks all the time now that he's had a kid, he says, my kid is never going to be smarter than AI. And this is a talking point.
That's what he said?
Yeah. This is a selling point for him. And this is like something, you know, and I use the term everything machine. Like, they are basically trying to sell you an everything machine. They're trying to tell you, buy this one thing and it will solve all of your problems and all of humanity's problems. You need a digital assistant? Check. You need someone to tutor your kids? Check. You need a doctor that gives you good healthcare advice? Check. You need a therapist that doesn't cost any like thousands of dollars? Check. Humanity needs to solve climate change? Check. Humanity needs to eradicate poverty? Check. I mean, like, when you think about all the things that it's saying that it's going to, they're promising you through this technology, it's completely an incoherent vision. But also, like, it is something far beyond what any other company has previously promised before. And so I do think that the religious rhetoric has escalated. And also, the trade between, like, treating users well, taking care of users, is breaking down. Like, when we think about the fact that teens are now getting so addicted and starting to use these tools as confidants, and then some of them are, it's leading them to suicide. Like, that is not them taking care of users. This is a technology that is deeply malfunctioning, that is not actually providing benefit to people. And yet, like, huge parts of the population are still addicted to it. So right. there is a level of like, these AI companies have passed a point. This is why I call the companies empires. They've passed a point where they're actually giving you a fair exchange of value for using, like, the product. They're just addicting you, hooking you in, kind of excavating you of all of your data, eroding your critical thinking to remove your agency, and then telling you that it's okay because it's going to just be a magic wand that solves all of your and humanity's problems. It's just of another level than Apple ever engaged in.
That's the voice of Karen Howe, our guest, the author of the book Empire of AI. Karen, as you were talking, I'm just still kind of fixated on the quasi-religious thing. And also, just kind of, let's combine it with the title of your book, Empire. So we'll start with Empire. You know, there was the old saying with the British Empire, the sun never sets in the Empire because it's such a vast thing, right? That's all you know. And if we're talking about religion, all I know is my universe, my God, my, you know, whatever my religion is, that's all I know. So I don't know what it means to be a Buddhist. I ain't trying to go there if I'm a Baptist. I don't know about those Muslim folks. I just know this, right? And that's the entire universe. And thinking about chat in OpenAI, I was thinking to myself, well, to your point about Apple having a bad product, you can always go to Android. You could see Android down the street. You could walk around the corner and there it is, saying, I am an alternative. But heck, I'm on here and I don't even know the alternative to OpenAI. Where do I go? What's the comparison that I can go to? Is it on Google? Is it the same thing? You know, I don't know. It all just seems like one vast universe and there is no choice. This is God, and maybe that is that's even a bigger difference, that we don't have a way to compare products. Nobody's on TV saying Deep Chat or OpenAI, here's the comparisons, you know, and if you don't like that, pay $20 a month and here's something brand new. We know that Elon Musk and these other folks have stuff that's out there, but this is still the main one, that even if you have another name, it's still connected.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually a deeper problem than that, in that even if you do know the alternatives, they're all giving you the same exact thing. They're not real alternatives. They're all built on the same kind of extraction, exploitation, religious fervor, and they all break down in the same ways. They all have, going back to the teen mental health issue, many of the products have now led to the same exact harm. So are they really alternatives? I'm not actually so sure. Just changing brand name, maybe, but the vision.
Why wouldn't they be any different? Is there opportunity for them to be really different? Or why are they all kind of the same thing?
It really goes back to that quasi-religious belief system, because they are ultimately not trying to offer just a product and service. That's only one facet of these organizations that are building these things. The other facet is they're trying to push for the creation of this artificial general intelligence. And because all of these companies have sort of pegged their goal to that AGI religion, and they're competing with one another to try and get there first, they're all just traveling the same path. They're all replicating one another, and instead of, you know, genuinely innovating on totally different ideas, totally different products and features, by just stealing each other's ideas back and forth to try and capture whatever user base one or the other has already developed. And it's a really strange, I've never really seen anything like this before, where so many players in the tech industry, so many, you could argue, really, really smart, talented tech developers are all doing exactly the same thing and have absolutely lost their muscle for thinking different.
Right. I want to come back to this thing about losing muscle, because I want to ask you about the MIT study that talked about brain function when you become so reliant on that. But I do want to get to this. You had a fascinating quote in one of your chapters. I think it's the last chapter, when you're talking about how they were trying to use this to keep the Maori religion together. There were people that had altruistic views. But in it, you go, data is the last frontier of colonization. The empires of old seized land from indigenous communities and then forced them to buy back with new restrictive terms and services if they wanted to regain ownership. AI is just a land grab all over again. Big tech likes to collect your data more or less for free to build whatever they want to whatever their end game is, and then turn it around and sell it back to you as a service. So this comes to the real heart of things. And we started off by talking about the data centers being built. And you talked about, like, they're taking everybody's creative endeavors and putting them in a thing, and et cetera, et cetera. So let's build on this last colonization thing, because I think this is what hits to the heart of your book, and also to what we're looking at right now, especially with this this guy in office. We'll talk a little bit about him too.
Yeah, that quote was from Keone Mahalona, who's a native Hawaiian and now lives in New Zealand, also known as Aotearoa, with his partner Peter Lucas Jones, and who's Maori. And the two of them are, their life mission is to fortify the indigenous cause. So they really, they run a nonprofit media organization called Te Hiku Media. It's a Maori radio station in New Zealand. And they also do a lot of work to revitalize the Te Reo Maori language, because it is one of the many indigenous languages that was almost lost after colonization. And what Keone was saying in that observation, which I think is an extremely profound one, is that based on his personal history of having experienced colonization as an indigenous person, and then experienced the way that the AI industry operates now as a technologist and as just a person that exists in the digital world, he's saying that it is exactly the same process. Empires always lay claim to resources that are not their own. They always try to take your resources, the things that you own, your agency, and make it seem like it was always theirs. And so then they make you pay for something that actually originally started as yours. And so that's what he was saying. Like, it's like back in the day, the old empires, they just took people's land by rewriting the rules before they could even understand what a European legal system was. And then they sold that land back to you when it was at first like you actually owned that land. And in the same way, these companies, they're hoovering up all of our data, all of our IP, and that's stuff that we own, but then they're turning it into this AI and then forcing us to buy back the thing, the very thing that was ours in the first place. And so that is, I think, the core idea that I try to convey in my book, is that these companies, the reason why I call them empires, is because they're no longer operating like normal businesses that provide you a value and then you pay for that value. They are just taking what is yours and forcing you to pay for something that was free in the first place. And they're accumulating an extraordinary amount of wealth and extraordinary amount of power from this churning of seizing resources and forcing you to pay for it. But what happens to everyone else is a deprivation of the things that were originally theirs and deeply precious to them, and potentially even like life-sustaining resources for them.
One of the things that you talked about, and I told you to bookmark this, was the study that came out of MIT where you, you know, wrote with editor, I believe, right, for the review. And the study was talking about brain functions. And over the years, we've seen these brain, you know, these studies on brain functions. I remember the United Nations had one just went during the day of the digital immigrant, digital native. They were doing a whole thing and they said, look, people's brains are designed to take in certain information, but this is the result. And for lack of a better word, critical thinking goes out the window, is how some people described it. With this new thing that you all had, that was even more disturbing. Could you kind of break that down for us, what they found? Because it was like, they were saying that people's brains aren't able, people aren't able to think, literally.
Yeah, basically, the top line is just the more that you use ChatGPT, the more your brain atrophies on it with critical thinking skills. So even like grown adults that have been, you know, doing critical thinking for a long time, just starting to use ChatGPT then for too long and becoming too dependent on it leads to actual brain mass going away when they're scanning your brains. And so that then leads to the question of what does that mean for kids who have never even developed that skill in the first place that then get addicted to this technology? How is that going to literally form their brains from an even younger age and potentially lock that in? And this is something that, it's not just the MIT study now, there have been a number of other studies that have come out that have shown that the longer someone uses these tools for cognitive tasks, the more that they are unable to perform those cognitive tasks without the tool. And this is a huge problem, not just because it creates this dependence on the tool, but also because like these tools are, there's a very specific ideology baked into these tools. And so if you're just depending on this tool as your brain, what you're actually doing is just depending on like a particular corporation's set of values and what they have decided to put into this tool as your brain. So the most blatant example of this was when Elon Musk, his company XAI, which produces the chatbot Grok, for like one weekend just randomly started, every single prompt was spewing things about the quote unquote white genocide in South Africa. And it was because someone at XAI had programmed Grok to basically just say that one thing. And now in that instance, it was incredibly obvious because it was like such a weird anomalous thing. And it kept bringing up this topic that was completely irrelevant to every user prompt. But it is it showed a much more insidious thing that happens across all companies, which is that they subtly program these tools to project certain values, to project certain worldviews. And then when you get hooked on the tool and you lose your critical thinking skills and you're just using ChatGPT as your brain or Gemini as your brain or Claude as your brain, like that just, you just become part of, all your thoughts become molded by this worldview.
Right.
from this company, not actually based on, you know, the diversity, well, diverse experiences that people have lived.
And if you don't have the history, the grounding before this, then you don't know. And I always give an example, like if I go on some of these products and I go, hey, make a picture that shows the red, black, and green flag, you know, with a fist up, right? Well, that has a certain type of meaning. It resonates a certain type of way in, say, the black community. It's the freedom flag. It's, you know, means it means something. But you're hard pressed to get that picture without all of a sudden seeing the American flag somewhere in there, or, you know, some sort of, you know, I'll say, for lack of a better word, corporate value that's plastered in there, right? Yeah. I remember when we did some things for Palestine, and we were like, let's show the Palestinian flag, and, you know, let's show people doing stuff for freedom. All of a sudden it had all these other things that were like, well, not everybody wears a hijab, and what's the Star of David doing in here, you know?
Yeah.
And if you don't recognize that, you just think like, oh, you know, what's wrong with that? Until somebody goes, why is the American flag sitting right next to the red, black, and green flag when the red, black, and green flag comes about to maybe be antithetical to this? And so that's a real subtle thing, and you only know it if you have, you know, if you have some cultural competency and you understand history. But if it's being erased, you know, like my kids might not know that. They might not pick it up. Somebody else's kids might think it's perfectly all right. And it's all those little subtle things. Malcolm X is no longer a revolutionary, but he's a guy who's, you know, he was Obama before Obama, when they're the exact political opposites. But those things will put it together. And that's that subtlety that you talk about that can be very dangerous.
Yeah. You know, OpenAI just released Sora 2, which is their second generation video generation tool. And one of the things that I noticed right away was the fact that it allows you to generate historical videos. So it allows you to generate JFK, or it allows you to generate Martin Luther King Jr. and to rewrite his speech. And that is, you know, to talk about dangers of rewriting history, is it brings that to even another level, where not only are the chatbots themselves kind of creating these analogies or statistical associations that are not necessarily grounded in history or context or lived experience, but they're also now generating things that people might mistake for actual history.
Yeah. And so at a time when history is being erased and not allowed to be taught in schools, et cetera, et cetera. The question I was going to ask you, which I forgot, but now I remember, and it's a big part of your book, is worker exploitation. So this was connected to empire. So part of empire is to exploit the people of these lands. And so looking at these data centers and what was going on in places like Kenya and other, let's talk a little bit about that, because that seems to be part and seems to be, you know, right along line what you were talking about with empire, that now you have folks working for pennies, you know, at these data centers, whether they're overseas or they're in, you know, depleted neighborhoods here in the, you know, in the States, well, they're making not millions, not billions, but soon to be trillions. And, you know, and you're making $2 an hour. So this exploitation has, to run the empire, there's some physical labor that needs to be used, and that's often overlooked and not talked about.
Yeah, so in order for chat bots to learn how to chat or to learn how to do anything that they have ever been able to do, they have to be taught how to do it by a human. And AI companies in Silicon Valley, they'll hire thousands of workers in low-income countries and low-income neighborhoods to perform this work so that they can pay them as little as possible to do this work. And so I went to Kenya to meet with workers that OpenAI had contracted at the time to perform effectively content moderation on what would become ChatGPT, because when OpenAI was scraping the whole internet and training its models on things that things indiscriminately, blog posts, Reddit posts, Wikipedia pages, parts of the dark web, they captured a lot of really grotesque gunk in that training set, and they needed these Kenyan workers to eradicate that out. And these Kenyan workers ended up experiencing the same exact traumatic symptoms that content moderators of the social media era experienced. They had PTSD, they had anxiety, depression. Some of them, after doing this project, could not hold down another job for many years because they were just so broken down. And you would think that for something that's already so heinous and taxing, that it would be at the very least, a well-paid job, but it's not. These Kenyan workers were making often less than $2 an hour, which was not enough for them to even try and get some kind of pay for some kind of psychological counseling to overcome the trauma that they experienced from their jobs. And so some modern day scholars in Kenya have pointed out that this feels like a modern day version of slavery, where they are literally producing the lifeblood of what these companies then profit off of. Like, if you do not have the work from these workers, the company's products and services literally will not work. They will not be able to sell them. They will not be able to make money from them. And so it is the economic backbone of the entire enterprise. And yet they see none of it, or practically none of it. And this is what all empires are like, in that part of the reason why they're able to expand so quickly and get rich so quickly is because they are not paying fair amounts to the people that are generating all the economic value for them.
And to your point about addiction, you could say this to folks right now, that the product you're using is coming at the expense of Kenyans. And we find rationale, starting with, it's convenient. What else am I going to do? Where else am I going to go? I need to get this done in an hour, you know, and this will help me. And so, hence we use the technology, knowing full well what you described in the book is true and what I just mentioned is true. I have a million other questions, but I know time is short. So let me wrap it up with Trump's declaration and edicts for these tech companies, because those are very disturbing. It started off with talking about the surveillance, but one of the things that he's talking about is not only increasing it, but then he says he wants to get rid of woke AI, right? He doesn't want AI to have any type of values that reflect communities that he deems unworthy, right? Mm-hmm. So he wants it to be more Christian focused and more white centered and all these different things. And he wants to remove the guardrails. And he also, you know, wants to bypass any of the legislation that states like California, where I'm at, have put up to say, look, you just can't collect the data without going through, you know, at least me signing off on it, right? Mm-hmm. So your thoughts on the Trump thing, this push to get rid of quote-unquote woke AI, which I think speaks to even more what you were talking about, this what was now subtle may be very glaring in terms of what is removed and not even thought about in terms of AI, you know, with these AI chatbots. So how do we look at that, and where do we go from here?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, Trump is revealing yet again that these technologies are not neutral. They absolutely have values embedded in them, and you know, when authoritarians get a hold of them, they can shape those values. And I think we are seeing under the Trump administration, you know, a complete disregard, disrespect for any kind of democratic institutions, any kind of values that America has lived by for a really long time. And he is he's weaponizing these tools, these AI models, as yet one other tool in his toolbox for kind of imposing what he, like, his values and what he wants everyone to believe in, and how he wants everyone to live. And I think that should be the strongest signal that we've ever received, that that means these technologies that are painted as some kind of savior or some kind of all-powerful entity are actually these really, really insidious pieces of infrastructure that are slowly creeping their way into so many different facets of our lives and becoming vectors of brainwashing, you know? So I think it's so important for people to, when they're using these technologies, to keep their eyes wide open for the degree to which they're not only helping to continue to fortify the empire, because every time you use the tools, you are giving your data to the perpetuation of this endeavor, but also how much that use of the tools then changing you, like changing your constitution, your mind, your values in subtle or overt ways. And I guess that is sort of like my final appeal to people for why to take a step back and maybe not embrace these tools so wholeheartedly, is because they are part of a really sinister project to take away our agency, take away our values, and take away democracy ultimately.
Well, that's something that we're going to land on, and sobering words, but I think they're necessary for us to kind of reflect on that. Karen Howe, thank you so much. The name of the book, Empires of AI, Dreams and Nightmares in Sam Altman's World. And there's a lot there. There's a lot there to take in, and we appreciate you for doing this this groundbreaking work. I think people are going to come back and look at the book and be like, she was really on something, you know, years down the road. And that should be noted, and we should uplift it. So thank you. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. Ralph and out. Peace.
Hard Knock Radio. Rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m.